Okay, good evening, Erev Tov. We are Be'ezras Hashem, Be'ezrat Hashem, we're finishing Sefer Nehemiah. In fact, this little blue book, this is it. We've gone from cover to cover, which is really exciting. We went through Sefer Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Baruch Hashem. Whether we're wiser at the end of it, or maybe, I hope a little bit wiser than we were at the beginning of it, but these are still very obscure, particularly Sefer Daniel. Very, very difficult subject matter, but worthy of our attention. There's no question about that. Before we start, it's Chodesh Nisan. I want to just dedicate the shir in memory of my mother, whose yahrzeit will be at the end of Chodesh Nisan, but it'll be after we finish. So 27th of Nisan, which turns out to be Yom HaShoah also, though in our family, it really wasn't that generation that was affected. My grandmother's generation was very affected, but my mother's generation, not so. But it varied according to different families, but Shoma should have an aliyah. Yahrzeit is the 27th of Nisan, and that's coming up pretty soon. The final frontier, but that's the wrong program. The final subject that we are going to see in Sefer Nehemiah is really, again, very much in line with what Nehemiah has been doing, essentially, since the beginning. He is very concerned about the religious standards of the Jewish people. Okay, he wants the Am Yisrael, he wants the Jewish people to become more observant is the wrong word, more connected, more godly, I think is the word that I would use. And in order to achieve that, he understands that there are certain changes or certain improvements that have to be made, building the walls of Jerusalem, making sure that the yichus, so this is something that we've had over and over again, and we're going to have it again today, making sure that the chronology is correct, people know where they come from, who they're descended from, all of this is really significant. And as a final gesture, and this is something I want to go into in a bit more detail, Nehemiah is also going to deal with the problem of Chilul Shabbat. The reality was that in his day there was a real issue of people not observing Shabbos. They were doing business on Shabbos. Nothing really changes in all the years. And the way that Nehemiah dealt with it is something that we're going to talk about, hopefully a little bit towards the end, so that we'll have some handle on what exactly he did. So without further ado, we're going to look at it's chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel, and we saw last time just the story, this very unusual story, that while Nehemiah was back in Persia, reporting back to the king of Persia, this gentleman called Tavir was making a lot of trouble in the temple, was not doing what he was supposed to do. It turns out he wasn't Jewish, but he had a good connection with a guy called Eliashiv. And as a result of the connection between Tavir and Eliashiv, he started making an office for himself in the Beit HaMikdash. And Nehemiah said, this is not acceptable. And Nehemiah comes along, and he basically threw out all of the kalim, which Tavir was collecting, presumably gold and silver, whatever. He evicted him. That's probably the way to describe it. And he said, as a consequence of this, obviously he wanted people to know that there is no pesharot, there's no compromises when it comes to the kedusha, the holiness of the Beit HaMikdash. It's something that we have to be very wary about, we have to be very careful about. Nowadays, there are groups that go on to the Har HaBayit, and there are even rabbis who take you up there. I know Rabbi Kwawasa told me he went up there a number of years ago, and they have to put on soft shoes, but go to the mikveh. There's a whole bunch of preparations that you have to do in order to go up there. And even then, you can't go. There's certain areas that you go, but very, very limited. Rabbi Goren worked out exactly where you can walk. The Israeli army basically doesn't let you go up there at all. They're very unhappy about people going up there, because immediately you get a response from the Wakuf, which is the army, the Arab police, to throw you off. They've become now very aggressive and very, the word we used to use in England, very bolshy. They've become very bad about this, and it's a problem. It's a problem that in our holiest place we're not really allowed to go, and even to sort of daven a mincha or whatever it may be. They do not allow it. So this is the situation at the moment. Is that a status quo? I don't think it sounds to me like a status quo at all. But unfortunately, that's the situation. So going back to the days of Nehemiah, he wants to make this project, as and he uses the word tahor. He wants to make it as pure as tahor as possible. And this is verse 9. This is where we're going to start from. V'yom ro v'yitara l'shchot. Once I got this guy out of his office, out of his room, I made the office tahor. Now that presumably means that he cleaned it up. Whatever he did to it, we're not told that there's any sort of ritual activity that went on, but v'yitaru, he cleaned up the office. He basically got rid of all of the negative influence that Tovia was bringing into the Beit HaMikdash, and he threw him out. Doesn't say he killed him, he doesn't say that he did anything against the person, but he got the influence out. V'ashiva sham klei Beit Elokim, and instead I put there the vessels of the house of God, et ha-mincha v'lavona, and all the offerings, the meal offerings, and the lavona, and the frankincense, the stuff they use for the keteres. Yud. Ve'idaa ki manot ha-leviim lo nitana, v'yivchish the sadeh ha-leviim ha-shorim osem lachana. He had another problem. The problem was that the portions of the Levim were not being given. The people were not supporting the Levim. In other words, as much as Nehemiah laid the groundwork, people had not responded in the way that he wanted them to. This was a very big change for everybody, or going back to a system which they hadn't been observing maybe for a long time. This is, again, there are various waves of people that come to Eretz Yisrael, and this wave of people, this group of people that he's referring to, didn't seem to have the awareness that you have to give a certain amount to the Levim, and they didn't. So what happened? Yudala, v'ariva et askanim. So I quarreled with the skanim, people who were in charge. V'imra, maduan nezav beit olakim. Why has the house of God been forsaken? In other words, why don't people bring their dues? And I brought these prefects, whoever they were, and I put them in their place. And then the people started bringing, finally, the tithes, the wine and the oil, etc., to these storehouses. So it's all a question of getting people used to doing this, getting them into a habit, getting them into some sort of framework that they will continue doing it. And this, again, today is very challenging. Today what happens is that for many people in Israel, who are particular about Trumot and Masron, a lot of this is not something that we really get involved with very much because it's all done for us. If you go to the Shuk in Machne Yehuda, every store there has a big sign, Trumot and Masron have already been taken. So you don't really have much to do. The only time you really get involved with it, if you're on a kibbutz, and you're picking your own fruit, and whatever, and then there are various ways of making sure that that fruit is treated with the respect of Trumot and Masron, but it's not given to anybody, because still to this day, we're not quite sure who to give it to, so we leave it, eventually it rots or whatever, and is not used. And again, Tanuva deal with this, and the Rabbanut, and various other organizations. So that's just part of what we do today. But in those days, it was really halacha l'maaseh. You had to bring it, and you had to hand it over. Yud Gimel. V'otzra al otzarot Shelem Yakoen. I had to make someone in charge of all of this. So who was in charge? Shelem Yakoen. V'tzadok, ha-sofer, b'daya, menavim. These obviously were very important gentlemen, VIPs, and these were very, very significant appointments. V'al yadam chanan be'zakur be'matanya. These are considered to be honest people, and they can divide up the distribution to their brothers. Okay, and I mentioned this many, many times, and I'm going to mention it again in memory of my Rav from London. Also, his Yotzei is coming up very soon, 3rd of Iyar of David Cooper, Zichron Livrocha, really one of the great unknown Talmidei Chachamim in the world. And he told me once, he said that the greatest title that you could have in Eastern Europe before the war was not to be called a Frumma Yid. Nowadays you talk about Frumma Yid, and, you know, and every use this expression. He said the greatest honor that a Jew could be given would be to called an Elecha Yid, to be called an honest Jew. If you were known as, like he says here, Ne'amonim, you were someone that people would trust, someone would have implicit faith in your honesty and integrity, that was the greatest honor that a person could be given, to be called an Elecha Yid. It's really quite something. I mean, I don't know how the world has changed, but for the better, I'm not quite sure.
It sounds like a familiar name from someplace else. Is it just a...
Yeah, Tzadok seems to be a common name amongst the Kohen. We had him before. We had Tzadok in the time of David. So it's not the same. Maybe it's a family name. I just don't know. You're right. There are certain names that do regenerate and do repeat themselves in the course of history. So you're absolutely right. There are names that come up here. Matanya is a name that you come across today in Israel. That's a very a nice name that people use today, for calling children sort of unusual names.
It means Dorothy.
Sorry?
It means Dorothy.
Dorothy, Matanya. Yeah, okay. I have to explain that one. But it's a good one, yes.
It's worthwhile to note that Nehemiah's ability to evict this guy, what's his name?
Tovia.
No, Tovia was the guy that he knew, the guy who actually had installed himself.
No, Tovia, that was the bad guy. Eliashiv was the good guy. Or at least he was the guy that Eliashiv was one of the Kohanim who...
Who's the one who had set up his...
Eliashiv set it up, and right. Tovia was the one who lived in the room. He turned it into his office.
So the fact that Nehemiah was able to evict him.
Yeah.
This guy who he's evicting has got clout. He's got.
Yeah.
Evidently, he's got wealth. He's got some kind of influence that he's able to sit there.
Yeah.
But Nehemiah evicts him, and that's it. That's all we hear about it.
Yeah.
And add that to this that what you're saying about being Naaman. It hints at how they understood human value in their society. If you've got the wallet, then that's the end of the story.
Exactly.
You
know, exactly.
You wouldn't be able to evict the guy.
Correct. Correct. But then it was a bit more a different set of values. And I think that's a very good point, Shkar. That it is very, very important. And again, as I said, you know, the Jewish society, as somebody put it once upon a time, I think Isaac Bernstein said it like this. He said that we used to have, originally we started off with Harav, and then we used to have the Gaonim, Saburoin, you know, you go through all the different levels. Till today, you have to have Harav, HaGaon, HaAdir. You know, here today, all the titles get completely blown out of proportion in the 21st century, in the 20th century, much more than you ever used in the earlier days. To this day, I still... treasure the fact I was neighbor with someone called Shlomo Fischer. Reb Shlomo Fischer is one of Dayanim of the Bedat. And he lived in Mevaseret Zion, which is where I was living. And once he wrote a paper for me or whatever, he gave me some sort of letter. And at the bottom he wrote, Heikuv Shlomo Fischer, Heikuv HaKatan. HaKatan Shlomo Fischer, the small person, Shlomo Fischer. And this Shlomo Fischer, believe it or not, was a man who knew... Literally, he probably, if he knew Shas and Poskim, that was an understatement. It was an unbelievable thing. You learn Musa, you learn a lesson from people like that. That it's not about the titles, not about the honor. It's really much more, you know, sort of about their connection to God, their honesty, their integrity. Yeah.
Sam Sofer, I think, might have been Sam Sofer, said that at the Mayor of Lebanon, the time that it was established was a big chumra. His mana was already a big chumra.
Yeah, and it went down. Yeah, it's very sad. It's very sad. The standard.
Easy to get narrow.
Yeah, you're right. It's just. Yeah, nowadays I know I don't even want to go there. Let's move on. Let's stay in the biblical world. You're done it. And now what happens is that Nehemiah is going to finish the sefer with a kind of tefillah. As I said, very personal sefer, and he's going to say to God, "Please remember all of these efforts that I made on behalf of Yerushalayim, on behalf of the Jewish people," and you know he's recording it. So Yud Dal Zochrali Alahay Azor, please remember, my God, oh this Ve'al Temach Hasadai, do not take away my good deeds. Asher Asiti BeBeit Alahay Mishmarav. In other words, he's praying to Hashem that please God look upon what I did favorably. And he goes on, and here comes the thing about Shabbos. This is interesting. It's all interesting, but listen to this. So in those days, Ra'iti b'Yehuda, Nehemiah is talking, I saw in Yehuda, Dorchim Gitot b'Shabbat, that they were doing their, pressing their grapes on Shabbos. They were basically working. And this is one of 39 melachot. Umeviyim ha'remot v'omsim ala chamorim, and they used to then load up the animals with all these piles of whatever they were, grain. The grapes and the figs and whatever, the burdens, Mivim Yerushalayim Yom HaShabbat, used to bring on Shabbos to Yerushalayim. V'ayid b'yom michram tzayin. And I warned them on the day that they would start, that they were selling provisions. In other words, basically, and Nehemiah said, I warned them they should stop doing this. V'atzorim yashuba mviyim dag v'chol mecha, and there were people there, non-Jews, who would bring their fish and they would bring things to sell. In other words, initially what he did is that he managed to convince the Jews to stop doing it, but there were non-Jews who got used to bringing their wares, the market day. They turned it in Shabbos into a market day, and they would come to Jerusalem. And he says, and what I did, I quarreled with the dignitaries, the people in charge of Yehuda. What are you doing? You're mechal Shabbos. All right, and this again is so interesting. In the modern state of Israel, there's a fantastic story. The book, if you want to look for summer reading, I read today that Rav Lau should be gezunt. He's nearly 80 years old. He's Sro Lau. He's just giving up his chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. I think it was the second time he was chief rabbi there, after being chief rabbi of Israel. And you have to read his life story. It's written in English from the depths. And in Hebrew, something ishlachat yad. It's a pasuk from the Akedah. Good evening. And Rav Lau writes their fabulous story that in 1948, his uncle was the Rav in Kiryat Motzki. Kiryat Motzki is right in the north. And that time they were taking over the railway, which was running, even in those days, the British had built a railway from Tel Aviv, and it went right up to Nahariya. And they wanted to run it, like the buses in Haifa, they wanted to run the railway on Shabbos. And this Rav, I forgot now the rabbi's name, it's sort of come to me, he decided he was going to make sure this wasn't going to happen. The railway was not going to run on Shabbat. So he went down to Tel Aviv to what is called the Kiryat, where all the politicians were congregating, and he went to the Minister of Transport. And he went to him, and he sat there, and he cried and cried in his office, and he said that I just can't, with all faith, all honesty, allow, that I ask you not to allow the railway to be running on Shabbos. And the minister agreed, and he didn't run. And the minister said that Rabbi, I'm sure you're happy with the fact that apikorsim kama ani, atem mitasekim apikorsim kama ani. That means that you're glad that you've got godless people like me to deal with. Because the reality is, I'm godless, but I respect what you said. This was the comment that was made at the end. It's a wonderful story. And again, it shows that there is this sensitivity. It's not easy on Shabbat, obviously, but one recognizes this, even in, sort of areas where you don't expect it. Haifa's got a lot better than it used to be, certainly Tel Aviv, till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, then you see buses going around, but most of the time on Shabbos is really with, there is that atmosphere in Israel which you can't really compare to anywhere else. So the Nechemiah is facing this tremendous dilemma. Chilul Shabbat, what is going to be? And Yud Chet, he says this was a sin that we did originally. That's why I went into the exile. And God brought upon us, he brought evil upon us in the city. You're going to continue breaking Shabbos. And now he says what happened was that as the gates of Jerusalem began to cast shadows, in other words, it was just coming towards the end of the day, and Shabbos was coming in. He couldn't stop the non-Jews coming, but he could close the gates. And that's exactly what he did. Very smart. He didn't want to start a fight or a battle with them. He just made it absolutely clear that you don't bring your goods to Yerushalayim on Shabbos. You will have no buyers whatsoever. And I said, don't open the gates after Shabbos. And even had guards on the gates. Nothing would come in on Shabbos. That was the way he dealt with it. Amazing. And the guys, the peddlers, they didn't take the message. They stayed out overnight. They waited till Shabbos morning. They waited once, and then they came back the next week, but they realized that was it. Yerushalayim was closed. And Nehemiah says, I went out to them, and I said, why are you here? Why are you putting up your tents next to the wall? And he says, now if you're really going to make a threat against me, then I'm going to respond. In other words, behind it was the sense that he wasn't going to be a pushover. And they got the message and they never came back. Fascinating. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in a minute. And he says, finally, so about this Shabbos, he says that I told the Levim to be Mekadesh Shabbos, and this may be the origin of what the Gemara says. They used to blow shofarot. Nowadays in Yerushalayim, you hear the siren going off, announcing Shabbos beginning. You know, there's something very special about that. And Gamzot Zachali Elohai, and he says, please, oh my God, my Lord, remember this. Have mercy on me in the Rov Rachamech. In other words, there is this sense that maybe, you know, maybe he's saying, and maybe I went too far. Maybe I pushed it too far, but Hashem, please, you know, sort of have Rachmonas, be kind to me for what I did, because I did it totally, as they say, L'shem Shemayim. Yes. Yeah, and it's right at the end, yeah.
He lost apparently Sefer Nehemiah's name because he took this, it seemed like what he did was to be remembered.
Yeah, yeah, there is this sense of wanting. It could be that even if it wasn't his intention, but this is the way it's perceived. You know, my feeling about that, and I saw that, my feeling about it is that, you know, his intention was totally L'shem Shemayim. Building the walls and everything, you know, he's a tremendous thing. All right, by the way, Mitch, I really appreciate the thing about Donald Trump and Nehemiah, the connection. Excellent. Both got a wall built by another country. That's really quite funny. Really quite entertaining. So that was a good one. Actually, it's a very good picture as well. The reality of it is that the... when it comes to Nehemiah, you know, maybe it could be misread. That's what I feel about it. And that's why maybe they, you know, he should not have left it in such a, you know, a sense of, you know, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, even though he's not really saying that. Right? You know what I'm saying? There is a kind of grey area over here with
it. No doubt that he was one of the Gedolim.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Nobody
talks. I mean, as I said, this Sefer is very unique. Even though the Chazal point out it's really continuation of Sefer Ezra, really is one Sefer in total, but it's got its own flavor, it's got its own style. No question about it. It's something to think about. I really haven't got a good answer for you, because your question is a good question.
What's the objection here?
The issue of Nehemiah sort of, you know, begging for God's mercy. You know, yeah, I mean, again, it may be looked upon negatively. You know, he keeps repeating this, because he keeps repeating this sentiment.
It seems
valid.
Desire.
Pure desire. That's right. But again, it just may be misread by, you know, seeing it that he's trying to score brownie points. He's trying to sort of, with God and with the people.
Score brownie points with God.
Yeah. Again, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's the right expression to use. Yeah.
I just interpreted that he says, "God, I hope I'm doing the right thing."
And that's the way I saw it.
And that what I am doing is that you'll look faithful.
Correct.
That reward me because I'm right.
Yeah.
Nobody says this.
The way that Nehemiah says it. All right, we'll go on. Chav Gimel. Gam, yeah.
Does he solve the problem of the intermarriage?
This is the last mention, and he's going to be working on this the whole time. Gam, look at what he says. Chav Gimel. Gam yom yohem, ra'ite yudim meishivu nashim ashdodiyot. We're back to that again. They're taking new wives from Ashdod, Ammoniot, Moaviot, you know, from all the countries around. They're back into intermarriage. And they've got children who are speaking, they're bilingual, but the wrong language. They're speaking the language of Ashdod. They don't speak Hebrew. According to the language of every people. In other words, you know, what's going on here? So he would not be too happy about people in Eretz Israel speaking who knows what, English or Yiddish or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, it is, but it's the part of the Philistine area, or whatever it became after the Philistines disappeared. So look what he does. So this is where he really got into motivated. I argue with them, I curse them, and I try to physically strike them. You know, as I came with fire and brimstone, Im titnu benotechem livneim, that I made them make an oath that they would not give their daughters to the sons of the non-Jews. V'im tisu benotechem livneichem, they wouldn't take the daughters of the non-Jews to their sons, but lachem unto you. Hallo al eile chata shloma. And this is so interesting. This is the sin of Shlomo. What a thing to mention. Hallo al eile chata shloma melech Yisrael. This is what Shlomo did. He made a big mistake. We know the story. There was no king like him. He was so beloved to God. Became the king of all of Israel. They also caused him to sin. In other words, these women, when you bring them into their, into your seviva, into your environment, they bring with them a whole mindset which is very hard to break. They bring with idolatrous practices, etc., etc. And therefore, he said to the people, are you going to do this terrible sin against God? To marry these women, and an example was that even the son of Yoyada ben Yashiv, who was the Kohen Gadol, he was Chatan, he was the son-in-law of Sambala Tachorani, of Sambala, who was, we know about him, he was one of the bad guys in the beginning. And Vavricheo Me'olai, and I drove him out. The fact that he married this, the daughter of this Sambala, was already made him possible. Zoch Olem Elohai Al Goli Akuna, please, O Lord, remember the fact that the fact that they defiled the kahuna, ubrit hakahuna leviim, they went against the covenant of the kahuna leviim. The tiharte mikonecha, and I purified the people. Va'mida mishmarot the kohenim leviim mishmarato, and I set up guards, watches for everybody in wherever they were working. Ulekorbano itzim ba'itim zumanot, and I made sure that they gathered the wood for these for the right time. The bikurim, and to bring the bikurim. These are certain, obviously, very important things which he had to arrange that wasn't being done. And then at the end, zachra le'olahai letova, please, O Lord, remember this for good. And that's the end of the sefer. And this again, you know, you get this sense of we're in the middle here. We're in the middle of a transformation, and it's happening, but he leaves us hanging. And in fact, you know, as far as we're concerned, this is it. I'm not sure if Divrei Yomim, I haven't seen it for a long time, I'm not sure the end of Divrei Yomim, if he goes beyond this stage. All right, we're going to move out of Torah Shebichtav, essentially, what we're calling the written Torah. We're going into the oral Torah period, and we'll have to sort of see how it develops from here. Yeah?
A similar expression at Zohar, what's at the end of
Horeb? At
the end of the
Megillah? Yeah, Gam Charvona Zachar. Well, Charvona is not he's not one of our hearers. We said, but he didn't say it. Right. And in fact, we are saying it, to spite him, because he was the one who, according to Chazal, he was the one who set up the gallows in the first place. So he wanted to save his neck by putting Haman on the gallows.
He said
he wasn't one of our heroes. He's Zachar Lato, but it's like tongue in cheek. Like the whole of Purim is really tongue in cheek, if you think about it. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that the Bayer Sheni was very
Yes and no. Yes and no. But it wasn't, because the temple was in disrepair because of the Greeks.
But during the Yeshua, that period, it was.
That period, but for a very short period of time.
This was not clean now.
Yeah.
During Hanukkah, during the victory, it was
clean. It was cleaned up. And then, but it didn't last that long. And by the time, really, 20, 30 years down the line from the Hanukkah story, you're already falling into problems. And then the Romans turn up. And then you get, what you do get is Herod's temple, which is, the Gemara says, was the most magnificent building. If you hadn't seen Herod's temple, then you have not lived. It says you hadn't, it was something else. What I want to do is deal a little bit, because we have a few minutes, with this thing about Shabbos. Because it is fascinating. What exactly did he do about Shabbos? And I'm not going to go through this whole thing. This is the Gemara, so if you just want to pass these around. This is from Gemara, Shabbos Kuf Chaf. Let me just take one. I'll take. Keep on here. Thank you. I can't give you the laws of Mux in 15 minutes. That's impossible. But what I want to show you is really just the first line, couple of lines of this statement from the Gemara Shabbos, Kuf Chaf Gimel, 123b. Because it's all about Nehemiah. When we read about Nehemiah here, the element of his halachic authority, right, is, I suppose it's clear, but it becomes clear when you look at it through the eyes of the Talmud. And I'll just read a little bit at the beginning. Tana Rabbanan, it's a statement of the rabbis, it's a brighter. Barishona, Hayu Amrim, Shlosha Kelim Nitalim B'Shabbat. Originally, three special types of kelim, types of vessels, were allowed, nitalim, to be moved, to be taken on Shabbos. Miktsar shel devela, zuama listran shel kedera, v'sakin ketana shel gabei shulchan. Right? In other words, basically saying that for Shabbos purposes, only those three things, a certain knife and a certain item which they would use for cutting devela, is a gourd, is some sort of, you know, big just for food purposes. Those three items were allowed, but the implication of the Gemara is nothing else was allowed to be moved. And then he tiru v'chazari too. Then the rabbi starting allowing more and more things to be moved. V'chazari tiru ad sha'omra, until they said, kol ha'kelim nitalim b'shabbat, everything can be moved on Shabbos, chutz min ha'mesek gadol v'yateid shemachrisha, is some sort of enormous saw, or yateid is some sort of peg which they would use for a machrisha, for a plow. Those things were not allowed, but everything else was allowed. And now the Gemara goes into a whole discussion, my itir v'chazer itir v'chazer itir. What does it mean? They allowed it, and then they allowed more, and then they allowed more. I'm not going to go through all that. That is the essence of the laws of Muktzah. I just want to show you the bottom line. It's the last three lines. Amar Rab Chanina, says Rabbi Chanina, b'yemei Nehemiah ben Hakalia nishnei mishnazot. This whole lesson that we're just learning was taught in the days of Nehemiah. Dichtiv, because it says, we just read the pasuk, b'yamim ha'hema ra'iti b'yuda drachim, dorchim gatot b'shabbat. I saw the people pressing their presses on Shabbos. Umeviyim ha'remot, and they would bring all these piles of corn and whatever, and wheat, and they were trying to sell it on Shabbos. And obviously the suggestion is that the laws of Muktzah, this is what the Gemara seems to be suggesting, seem to have begun, if that's the way to describe it, in the days of Ezra. And the days of Nehemiah, excuse me, but I suppose you call it Ezra as well. That till the day of Nehemiah, there seems to not been a law of Muktzah. What happened was, Nehemiah came along, and he saw that Shabbos was not being observed, so that's what it says, Barishona, Nehemiah made a special takana that everything would be forbidden. Right? You couldn't even move anything. Basically, he closed up every loophole that was possible, except for three things which are needed for basic requirements of food on Shabbos. That's really what it boils down to. The knife and these other things. And then, as the people started becoming more observant, he relaxed the halakha, and it became more and more allowed. Then you could move things, as they say, klishim lachta laheta, klishim lachta lis, if you know this terminology. I'm not going to sort of go crazy on that now. You can ask Roy Bellazon, I'm sure he'll give you a very big insight into all this. This is really the halachis field. But the reality of it is that Nehemiah seems to have cured, that was the suggestion, the whole issue of observance of Shabbos by stopping people keeping Shabbos, by stopping people breaking Shabbos, by making Shabbos so heavy and so intense that nothing could be moved on Shabbos except very, very few items. And again, I'm just going to make one comment, then I'll take Abe's question. And obviously, to me, the obvious question is, and it's not what the rabbis talk about, is when you think about it, this is not the way you would go about it today. The way you would go about trying to get people to keep Shabbos is not by making the laws so restrictive, because people turn around and say, you know, I didn't keep it before, I'm not going to keep it now. Why should I? How are you going to affect me? It seems that the power, the koach of Nehemiah was so amazing, so impressive, that when he said something like this, people responded. They really held him in such high esteem, even if they were not observing the way that he expected them to, that it seems that whatever he said, as they say, whatever he says goes. And this is something, this gives you an even greater insight into this man, Nehemiah. Yeah. That's a very nice thought, and I just want to hand these up, because there's a lot of discussion about keeping yours in Israel. You know where we're going with that whole subject. All right, Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Yeah, I've got one here. Thank you, Rabbi Yaakov Emden. In his day, this is 300 years ago. made a statement that if I had the power, I would have cancelled Kidneyot 300 years ago, because he felt that the whole thing was irrelevant. But he said it's become such a minhag and such
he's
a force.
Hero.
Yeah, he really is a hero. But he was a very, very, very interesting man. You need to spend more time reading about Rabbi Yaakov Emden. He really was unique.
How can we talk to somebody about him? What did his father say about keeping Yantif in
Israel? One day, it was also, right. Absolutely.
Because Emden says people who are from Chutzar should keep 2 days.
Yeah, there's a whole, it's his father-in-law, Rav Chacham Tzvi, father-in-law, Chacham Tzvi.
Yeah.
And with the amulets and with the whole thing with the Shabtai Tzvi story, he was a pretty controversial guy. I just want to show you this. I got this off the Bar Ilan CD. For some reason, I looked at it and I didn't give the name of the sefer here. So if you have the Bar Ilan CD, you can look at it. Just show you one or two issues here, which are raised on that Gemara that we just saw, because it's interesting. And you'll see what the problem is. According to what we're suggesting, the law of Muktzah was invented by Nehemiah. Is that true? So he says here, this rabbi, and I think it's a contemporary, if I'm not mistaken, I don't remember now the name of the sefer. So it's section A, and it's underlined. Umavua b'gemara, Khan, the Gemara says, should be made Nehemiah gozal issa tiltul, dahainu issa Muktzah, that the whole law of Muktzah came about in the days of Nehemiah. Umishum, gede shelo yavo laso issurim b'shabbat. And it would stop people breaking Shabbos. But he says, v'inei lichara yesh la'ayin. I don't understand. Mehod b'sachim, because there's another Gemara in Psachim, which talks about mevashel gidan asher b'chalav b'yontav. What did you do? You cooked this piece of meat in chalav, in milk on yontav. And how many makas? You know, you're going for big time sinning here. So how many times can you get stripes? So loke chomesh, the Gemara says, you get 5 makas. And the Gemara explains why. V'amrin and sham, we explain. One of the reasons that you would be punished for doing what you just did is because of the fact that you did something which was against the laws of Muktzah. Go to the next line. V'yakshin, on the fourth line where it's underlined. U'muktzah deraitahu. Amalei in. So one second, now the Gemara in Psachim is saying Muktzah is min hatar. So this, you can see, is a problem. How can we say that Nehemiah invented the laws of Muktzah if they're already min hatar? All right, so this is really the question. What did Ezra do, which, in the laws of Muktzah, which was not there before? And that's really the point. And this is where we get to very, very interesting discussion over here. And again, I'll just read a little bit more. At the end of that line, they say that the Torah says, don't do any work. Adkan, hare, underline. Lehed yad Muktzah isu min haTorah. It's forbidden from the Torah. Im kein, my itzrichu b'imei Nehemiah likzov lesotil v'muktzah. What is Nehemiah doing? If the Torah forbids it, then that's it. Period. V'kein hu b'beitza, and he brings another Gemara in Beitza with a similar discussion takes place. Go to the next underlining where it says kamatei rutzim nemru b'zachronim. There are a number of answers which are given here in the Achronim about this problem. Again, the very simple problem. Bottom line, what did Nehemiah actually do in terms of the law of Muktzah, which the Gemara suggests was his tremendous way of trying to bring people back to observing Shabbos? What exactly did he do? If the law already existed in our Torah, then the law existed. What is Ezra? What is Nehemiah doing? So there's 2 suggestions here, and they're very, very interesting. That's why I wanted to share this with you, because it's unusual. Listen to this. Number one. Pnei Yeshua Bebeitza Sham Katad. The Pnei Yeshua, one of the famous Achronim, one of the standard commentaries on the Gemara, the Leka Lameima Desvirle Lerabba the Muktzah Deraita B'chol Mokam. He basically attacks this in a Gemara way. He says that when we said originally that Muktzah is Min HaTorah, it doesn't mean everywhere. There was a certain element where Muktzah was applied according to biblical law, and in some cases Muktzah was only applied according to rabbinic law. That's a similar thing to what we have today. We have milk and meat, let's say that's forbidden to be cooked and to be eaten together, min ha Torah, but milk and chicken, we know, is something which the rabbis tacked on because they felt that you couldn't forbid one and allow the other. So one is an allowance, prohibition, which is forbidden by the Torah, and the other one is a prohibition, which is forbidden by the rabbis. And basically what the Pnei Yeshua wants to suggest is that when Nehemiah came along and made the laws of Muktzah, what did he do? He added to the rabbinical side of Muktzah. Okay, the biblical side of Muktzah was already in existence, but what Nehemiah decided was rabbinically, Midrabanan, he tried to make the laws a bit stricter so that the people would get the message that you don't play around with Hilchot Shabbat. Okay, so that's what suggestion number one, and that, as I said, is a very, what I call a very achronish type of Gemara suggestion. But go to the next paragraph, because this is very interesting. He brings Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer, Ramosha Sofer, who is really a classic. The more I sort of read and sort of find out about him, the more you realize this was an extraordinary rabbi in every sense of the word. And he says like this, Ubishalib Shailot Chuvot, next paragraph. Chatam Sofer, Chaim Simanain Te. Chidesh Bezeh Yesod. He makes a tremendous chiddush. Rabbi Moshe Sofer wants to suggest on the basis of this problem. What's the problem again? Nehemiah, what is he doing? If it's forbidden from the Torah, Muktzah is forbidden, then what is Nehemiah doing? He says, no. We have to understand. The Trei Gavnei Muktzah Ikah is a bit sort of like brisk. He says there are two types of Muktzah. Yesh Muktzah Shehu Isad Midoraita. There is Muktzah forbidden by the Torah, like the Bnei Yeshua said, like the other rabbi said. O al koponim karov li isad Torah. Or it's close to being forbidden by the Torah. What does that mean? Vehu kishochel davar sheya Muktzah umechusah achana. For instance, if you're going to eat something which was not prepared and was not set aside before Shabbos, that already gets you into the category of Muktzah. That's why we prepare a lot of the things we do before Shabbos. Dezei yafina mikro, echinu beyom hashishi, on the sixth day, meaning Friday, you should prepare things before Shabbos. She'ein lechol b'Shabbos midi delo hava mucham erev Shabbos. You shouldn't eat something on Shabbos which is not prepared from before. This is talking about obviously food and etc. things that we need to process. For instance, something which was created on Shabbos, like an animal gave birth or an egg was laid on Shabbos. You didn't think about it because it was something you weren't going to use on Shabbos. Oh, have said, or something which was would have been a reason you didn't want to use it because it would be a loss or whatever. Such a thing is forbidden. It was something which, when Shabbos comes in, you had no intention to use it. You're not supposed to move it on Shabbos. But aval, now here comes the crunch. That's the general law of Muktzah. Aval isur tiltul Muktzah, and this is the golden rule. And if you've learned today a halacha, it's really the important halacha of Muktzah. Muktzah is not about touching. A lot of people make the mistake. Muktzah is about moving. Tiltul Muktzah, that is what Nehemiah added to the laws of Muktzah. Till Nehemiah came along, okay, there were certain things which were Muktzah in essence because of what they were, and people would not come to be involved with them on Shabbos for all different reasons. But the actual moving of Muktzah is something which Nehemiah made into a specific, what we call takana, special law, and that was what Nehemiah added. And he says, Lo ne'ema mishum de mechusa achana. This was now moving, it was not because it wasn't prepared. De lo yitzricha achana, don't need to prepare, le midi d'achila, o ishtamshas, only things which are food-based or something like that. Avam, le tiltul gereda. But when it comes to tiltul, to moving, lo yitzricha achana, it does not require preparation. The Torah would allow you to move essentially anything. However, what did Nehemiah realize? That if you're allowed to move all these things all the time, your whole Shabbos goes away because you'll start moving money and you'll start moving documents and you'll start moving things to write with, and the whole Shabbos just falls away. It's like a regular day. So Varak b'yamei Nehemiah, even the New York Times, you know, you might move that, and I suggest you probably should not. Probably that is Muktzah, but for lots of reasons. Varak b'yamei Nehemiah ben Chakalia goes through al atiltu. So Nehemiah comes along and he forbids moving these things. Machmat Shehem Shayu Mezalzele Prutzim b'nyanei Hotzah b'Shabbos, because they were so bad, and that's the link. Here it doesn't talk about, in the Sefer it doesn't talk about Muktzah, it talks about they used to bring things on Shabbos. Obviously, what was the prohibition? Carrying. They were bringing things from outside the tchum, and even before you got to do business, they were already carrying all this stuff. So by Nehemiah making tiltul, making the whole thing of moving mutzah an issue, something that you shouldn't do, that was sending a message to the people who were initially breaking the laws of carrying, that not only should they realize the laws of carrying are being prohibited here, are forbidden, but even before you get to that, these items which are set aside because they are designated for business or whatever, they should not be moved on Shabbos at all. And this became a chiddush which really is with us to this very day. The reality of it is, and this is what I like so much, the Chassam Sofer says, yeah, of course there were elements of Muktzah which were min HaTorah, elements which were Midrabanan, like the Pnei Yeshua said, but he put it into such a beautiful framework over here. The elements min HaTorah are talking about what's called intrinsic things, which have an intrinsic prohibition within them, a stone or whatever that, you know, unless you prepare the thing as a doorstop, you can't move it on Shabbos. But when it comes to tiltul of things which normally would be allowed, Nehemiah saw, you know what? We cannot move these things on Shabbos. And that becomes Nehemiah's chiddush, the fact that what he added to the laws of Muktzah, to the laws of Shabbos. And he goes on a little bit over here, and he brings maybe some more questions, but that's really the point that I wanted to make over here. And again, it's a bit of a chizuk, I think, to come to the end of the Sefer, and to have this sense, and this is really where what I said before, that from Nehemiah onwards, we go from what we would call the era of Torah she'bichtav into Torah she'balpeh. We're going into the era of what we would call Rabbinic Judaism, which eventually is what it becomes. And we already get this sense from this little analysis of the laws of Muktzah that, you know, Nehemiah is becoming a bridge. They are becoming bridges from the world of Nevuah. Remember, we spoke about this, that there was a world of prophecy, a world which in which these things stopped at this time, beginning of the Second Temple. The last of the prophets were Haggai and Malachi, and that when they died, it was ended. And we go from that kind of direct connection to God, or to having some ability to get these messages from above, we went into a whole new situation, which really, from the days of Nehemiah onwards, which is what we now call Torah Shebaal Peh. And of course, this is a segue into encouraging to look at the Pirkei Avot, which we're going to read, Mitzvah Hashem, right through the summer. It's a great opportunity, if you haven't done it before, to study Pirkei Avot. You know, get the rabbi to give a shiur on Pirkei Avot. It's really so special. And that also becomes the bridge. And if you really want to invest in something, Benny Lau, the nephew of Rav Lau, has written this wonderful, it's four volumes, on the background of the rabbis of Pirkei Avot. And also, he talks a lot about what we just spoke about, the way that Nehemiah, Ezra and Nehemiah, become the bridge from the Tekufa, the period of Torah Shebichtav, into the period which we now clearly sort of understand of Torah Shebaal Peh. And again, I hope and pray and say to you that, you know, what Ezra said, what Nehemiah says at the end, you know, as much as we may not sort of be so happy with the sentiment, I would sort of say it very much as well, Zachra la'ay l'tova, that I hope God sort of remembers the learning that we've done. You know, l'tova should always be for good. You always have. I think l'tova here means you should always have a good feeling about it. As I say to my students, I say, it's not about the finals. They're all panicking. They've got finals in 2 weeks' time after Pesach. I said, it's about the learning experience. You can have finals and you'll forget about them in 5 minutes, but if you've had a positive learning experience, that you take away with you essentially for the rest of your life. Turns out that one of the Rebbetzins in Cherry Hill, where I'm living now, was in my class at Stern 15 years ago. And one of the things she came up with, oh yeah, Rabbi, you spoke about this, I do remember. I remember, I have no clue what I was speaking about 15 years ago, but she remembered. And it's very encouraging, very gratifying. You know, that was a learning experience, and I hope that you'll take that away. We'll talk about, you know, sort of maybe later in the year, but Bezrat Hashem, we should all have a great summer, great Pesach, Chag Kosher Sameach. Wish everybody well. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Have a good evening.